So the book that Senator Lieberman wrote is called The Sabbath, and in my chapter that I'm writing from my Basic Judaism book, I borrowed little bits and pieces from things he said there about his time when he was running for the vice presidency and trying to keep Shabbos, and pretty cool. So let's get back into Malacha. If you remember last week, we had Rabbi Lichtenstein here, which I hope you found interesting. I'm trying to showcase some interesting people for you guys. But the week before, we started delving into what is it that we don't do on Shabbos. And one of the things that we ruled out is, there's too many don'ts in this sentence. What are we trying to refrain from on Shabbat? So we say work. But we know that it's much deeper than work for two reasons. Number one, it's not just about not going to work. It's not just about being unemployed. It's got to be something else because, like, most of you have been to my home on Shabbat, and we have lots of people, and I'm running around, and I'm doing a lot of work. You know, when Shabbos is out, I often crash. I take my naps after Shabbos sometimes. I've been doing this for years because I'm working. I'm, like, exerting labor and effort. And I'm piling chairs up, and three more people came for lunch, so I have to get the little bridge table out and put it out, put the tablecloth. That's not. But if I go over to the light switch over there and go boom, that's work. But all the schlepping I was doing with the chairs is not.
But rabbinical work is allowed.
It's nothing to do with rabbinic, biblical, da da da. And it's not about rabbinical. I can't come in here and turn the light on. Even if it's to illuminate the synagogue. Now, we're going to talk about non-Jewish help on Shabbat. We'll get to that next week, please, God. But why is it that it's okay for me to do that, but I can't do the other thing, which would seem to make my life a little easier?
Because you're benefiting others on Shabbat. It's like for the experience of Shabbat.
Yeah, but even if why can't I put the light on for you then? Or for the congregation? I can't do that still. It's something having to do with creating.
Yeah, I was going to say, it was always strange when I learned that you can't play music, you can't play an instrument on Shabbat, because that would, for some people, be a relaxing thing.
Right.
Having to, like, fix it or, like, tune it.
Also fixing. So I want to dispel a couple of things. It has nothing to do with creating a relaxing environment. And it has nothing to do with the physical exertion of labor. A lot of people think anything that's too, you know, exhausting, you can't do. Now, there is a rabbinic category. Where, like, I'm not supposed to, like, you can take a brisk walk, but you're not really supposed to work out too much. But it's not breaking work. Because work is defined as what? And that's what I want to get into. Take a look at the article before you. This is where we left off 2 weeks ago. It's clear, to look at page 23 on the bottom. This is from Diane Grinfeld. It's clear that work, or to use the Torah's own term, malacha, is by no means, last paragraph, identical with physical strain or exertion. Right? This is shown by the simple legal fact. Take a look, page 24, that you are not a Sabbath breaker if you carry a heavy load inside your home, but if you carry even a small book from your house into the street, like if I have a paperclip left in my pocket and I walk outside with a paperclip in my pocket into a public domain and there's no Erev, I have done work. And yet in my home, I could see all those books there. If I took all those books out, piled them up on the thing, and then took them all back and put them back, as long as I wasn't sorting them, because that's one of the 39 acts of work, I haven't done any work. So it obviously has nothing to do with the physical exertion of labor. But if you carry even a small book from your house into the street, you'd be profaning the Sabbath. Nor is it true to say that what the Torah forbids is merely carrying on our everyday occupation. Sabbath laws include this, but they go so much further. What really is meant by work? Because the Torah says you shall not do no manner of work, can be ascertained only by a careful study of, and you guys, this is what the main theme running throughout the whole year, is how do you define terms from the Torah? Shoot from the hip, this is what I think it means. We have a tradition as to how to understand. And where do we find that tradition? How to break the code of these vague terms found throughout the Bible, the Hebrew scripture, the Torah, the Chumash, that's called the
oral tradition.
The oral tradition. And in Hebrew, it's called the Torah Sheba'al Peh. Baal Peh means if you, like, memorize something, right? Now, it was written down. Where is the oral tradition written down today, guys? In the form of the, guys?
Mishnah.
Mishnah, and then the? the Gemara, and together that's referred to as the Talmud. Okay, Mishnah and Gemara. It wasn't supposed to be written down. Remember, we talked about it. It was passed down, and then there was a historical circumstance. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi lived in the second century. Believed that if he didn't start writing stuff down, people would start forgetting, because Jews were getting all over the globe. Okay, this is the common refrain. Okay, and this is what separates the fellows from the non-fellows, from the people beneath the fellows, the people you would never even associate with, the common folk, who have never studied this beautiful Torah. Okay. A clear appreciation of the nature of Malacha is vitally important for the true understanding of the Sabbath, as the Torah itself means it to be observed, and as it is in fact observed to this day by those Jews mindful of their great heritage. The main source in the Torah for the definition of Malacha is the command that all the various activities necessary for the construction of the sanctuary, what's that called in Hebrew? The sanctuary?
Mishkan.
Mishkan, good. What's another weird English word that we use to translate sanctuary or Mishkan? The tabernacle, almost as helpful as phylacteries. Okay? And basically the Torah says that all the various activities necessary for the construction of the sanctuary should cease on the Sabbath. All these are thus expressed included in the term malacha, meaning any activity that was necessary to build. What was the sanctuary, guys? The Mishkan. What was it physically?
It was the resting place for God.
Supposed to create, yeah, but what was it consisting of?
Different materials.
It had these beams that created a courtyard, and in the courtyard you had the altar, you had the copper altar, you had the gold altar, you had the menorah, you had the Ark of the Covenant, all of this stuff. Any activity that was necessary to put that stuff together and take it apart, that's called malacha. How many activities went into putting the tabernacle together? It was mobile. There were 39 specific activities, okay? Here's a list of those activities taken from the Mishnah: plowing, sowing, reaping, sheaf making, throwing, blah, blah, blah. Now, they weren't random. They actually, does anybody know how many steps are involved in baking bread?
Yeah. You need ingredients?
Okay, but how many of these?
30
steps. There are 39 malachot. 11 of them were necessary to bake bread. Why were they baking bread in the tabernacle? Was it like a bakery? What were they doing?
Offering the
What kind of offering?
Or flour offerings.
There was a thing on the shulchan, on the beautiful gold table. They had what's called the lechem hapanim. They had the showbreads. And there had to be like 12 showbreads representing each tribe, freshly baked at all times. So they were actually baking. So 11 of the 39 activities were the 11 steps. Now I know what you're thinking. Why do you need 11 steps to bake? You just go to the ATM, that's step one, get the cash, and go to Whole Foods, that's step two, and then step three, give them the money. And now you're done. No, but there are actually 11 steps in baking bread. What are they? You have to plow.
Baking.
Why do you have to plow? Because there's...
The flour.
Well, forget the...
You have to plant the...
The soil has to be suitable for growing stuff. So that's plowing is pulling. Remember I said this 2 weeks ago? So you'll say, these have nothing to do with me. I'm not baking bread. I'm buying bread in the store. I don't even like challah. I came to Nava's thing because she's nice. I can do it to cook. Right? What is it? By the way, how is plowing applied today? That's what, every single one of these malachas apply. Not even though you don't plow.
Is that the example you gave, like in Central Park?
Good.
With like a bench or something?
Yeah, you're in Central Park and you're hanging out with your friends. Your back's starting to go, you're tired, you want to sit down on that, you know, so the bench is over there, so it's kind of a little heavy, so you just start dragging the bench over here. What are you doing?
Plowing.
Now, there's no ox, and I'm not trying to seed or plant anything, but it doesn't matter because the activity of turning over...
The soil.
So people, if you're riding a baby carriage or you're on your bike, and is it turning it over or is it flattening down? Flattening down is okay as long as you're not pulling up the soil. What if you're wearing certain kind of heels? And every time you go in there, that's why there's all this practical discussion about every one of the 39 acts of work. Don't think because we don't engage in these activities, we're not engaging in these activities. We certainly are. Every one of them somehow applies in a different kind of fashion. Okay, so those are the 39 activities. Now, if we examine the list, let's go back to our definition, 25 on the bottom, last paragraph. If we examine this list, we discover a surprising fact. They are seen to form a cross-section of all the main types of human productive activity. This can hardly be accidental. But it's not our purpose to inquire into possible reasons as to the building of the sanctuary. But what does concern us is that the Torah has given us a clear indication of the nature and scope of malacha. Can we call it from now on not work? Because work implies physical exertion or labor, and that's not it. We're just going to call it malacha. Malacha is the Hebrew word for work. Okay? In addition, certain times of malacha are mentioned independently in the Torah, like carrying, Exodus 16:29, Numbers 15:32, and lighting a fire. And in each case, important light, is shed on the Sabbath as a whole. So let's get the definition. The written law gives us the outline of the Sabbath legislation. The oral tradition fills it in, all the details. Skip three paragraphs down. What then is the unifying principle which underlies the concept of malacha? I don't know, maybe you can come up with it on your own. Look back, look at those 39 acts. Could you come up with one definition that somehow pertains to each of those 39 activities? Could you come up with a sentence that captures what is forbidden on Shabbat? Because technically, those 39 things are forbidden, and they're derivatives. Okay, so what is a definition of something? What is it? What's involved in every one of those activities?
The construction of
purpose. Purpose, good.
We're altering the state of something.
You're altering the state. It has to involve. It has to be deliberate. It cannot be accidental, incidental. Now, here's the thing. With the bench, I wasn't really looking to pull up the what was I doing? I was just trying to get the bench to the other side. So the fact that the bench pulled up the thing, is that really intentional? But here's the deal. If something is inevitable, it's called inevitable psik resha, the lonicha le psik resha nicha. There's an entire tractate of Talmud. People spend years learning all the laws of Shabbat, but I'll just give you one little clip on this. Very interesting. If something is an inevitable consequence of your action, even if you're not, that's not your intention, but there's no way to perform that activity without that resulting. There's no way to pull a bench that heavy across Central Park without pulling up some dirt. If the bench was light, it could happen, but it may not. That's not construed as intentional. It is construed as intentional if it's necessarily going to happen. And the example it's given is called psik resha. Psik means cutting off the head. The lo nichale. The person wanted to cut the head off a chicken. Kid wanted to play with the head of the chicken. It's a really ridiculous example. Just get over the example for a minute and just stay focused on the legality. And he is not interested in killing the chicken. He just wants to play with the head of the chicken. But there's really no way of removing the head of this chicken without actually killing the chicken. So it's called a psik resha. Meaning cutting the head, Raish's head, and he has no interest in a dead chicken. He just likes to play with a head, and it's a ridiculous thing. But it's sort of just so. But you're starting to say intentional change. Now what? There's only one malacha though that doesn't pertain to change. Can you think of one malacha, one of the 39 activities, where nothing gets changed and yet it's forbidden on Shabbat? Because that would be a good capture, yeah. Carry. You're not changing anything. You're just moving that sucker around. You're
changing the location.
You're changing the location. Okay, so I'm going to come back to carry. I'm going to give you a nice little theory here to operate with. Last paragraph on the page. Many Jewish thinkers have tried to formulate a central concept of this sort and so find the key to the whole vast system of the Sabbath laws. The exposition given by Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. You guys have heard me quote Rav Hirsch before. Mm-hmm. He was a rabbi, lived in the late 18, early 1900s in Germany. He was a great, great scholar. And he was like a very modern thinker of his time. And gave, so that's, I don't know, his ideas resonate with a lot of people. And he's one of the foremost Jewish thinkers of the last century, is very helpful. In arriving at his interpretation of Malacha, Rabbi Hirsch starts with the basic idea that the Sabbath testifies to God as the supreme creator of heaven and earth. Remember we said this when you make Kiddush? Did we say this? The first paragraph when you make Kiddush, you always stand. Why? Because a Jew in a court of law giving testimony always stands. And what are you doing when you're hearing Kiddush? The first paragraph, Yom HaShishim, Vayechulu Hashemayim v'aretz, in the sixth day God created. What are you doing? You are bearing testimony that God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. That's why people traditionally stand, at least for the first paragraph of Kiddush. Okay, because it's all about, right? So he says that the Sabbath testifies to God as the supreme creator. However, we are engaged in a constant struggle to gain mastery of God's creation, to bring nature under his control. By the use of his God-given intelligence, skill, and energy, he has, people, have in large measure succeeded. He is, now, this is, by the way, a very important idea. I could spend an hour talking about this. What is our job during the week? If our job on Shabbos is to rest, what's our job during the week? It's to work. But what does it mean to work? It's not just earn a livelihood. It's to make the world a better place. It's to use your God-given skill and intelligence to lift the world up. Okay? But what happens if you keep doing that and you don't take a break? I don't mean you burn out. That's what they told you in Hebrew school. Shabbos is great so you don't burn out. It's not what Shabbos is about. Okay, you can do that on Sunday. He is thus constantly in danger of forgetting his own creaturehood, his utter and complete dependence on the Lord of all things. He tends to forget that the very powers he uses in his conquest of nature, which, by the way, we're supposed to do on Sunday through Friday, are derived from his Creator, in whose services life and work should be conducted. In a world increasingly forgetful of God, so I'm sharing this idea also because in a world of like breakthrough of technology and just the everything that we have, which is amazing, this is, I think, incredibly, just resonates. It's very applicable and relevant. In a world increasingly forgetful of God, Israel was entrusted, like the Jewish people, were entrusted with the task of preserving this all-important truth for the future salvation of all mankind. God willed, therefore, that the Jew, while subduing and controlling his environment, like every other human being, has to also recognize and show that he recognizes that his powers are derived from one higher than himself. This recognition he is to express by dedicating one day of the week. And how do you do that? By refraining from what? Here's the line to underline, guys, last line. By refraining from, on this day, from every activity which signifies human power over nature. What we're refraining from specifically is any activity that expresses our power over the natural world. Okay? On this day, to next page, 28, we renounce every exercise of intelligent, purposeful control over natural objects and forces. We cease from every act of human power to proclaim God as the source of all power. See what happens when you pull back from showing that you're powering over the natural world? You pull back, you don't do anything, and what happens? It still goes on. The world still continues and functions without you. It's a way of shining the spotlight back on God once a week. In a world increasingly forgetful, says Diane Grunfeld, quoting Hirsch, of God. And it's easy to forget God when you can just do everything on your own. You know, primitive man, I guess, would be a little more God conscious because they needed him a little more. They probably prayed a lot more in those days because they couldn't cure a lot of things. And what happens when we're in COVID or we can't seem to get out of a pickle or we can't figure out a cure for something? All of a sudden, we're a little more faithful. But we don't want to wait for that. We want to do something every week, no matter how. And also, by the way, it's not a good thing what we went through in COVID. It's not a good thing that we haven't come up with a cure for cancer. God wants us to do that. That's what the rest of the week is for. What did God tell Adam in the Garden of Eden? The Kivshuha, he said, conquer the forces of nature, build hospitals, cure diseases. I created you and the world around you imperfect. Make it better. Hashem could have created everything perfectly, like himself. The essential characteristic of human, next paragraph, human creativeness is the intelligent purpose which directs it. This then is the important fundamental halachic principle which forms the basis of the whole of the Sabbath law, Melechet Machshevet Asra Torah. The Torah forbids as malacha the realization of an intelligent purpose by practical skill. Which, by the way, if you were to knock down a building on Shabbos, you're technically not involved in a malacha. Why? Because what's a malacha?
Creative.
It's destructive. The only time it would be forbidden to knock down, demolish something on Shabbat is if the purpose of demolition is construction. For example, in order to build a high-rise building here in New York City, what do they have to do for a couple of weeks? They got to dig and dig and dig until they got enough of a foundation to land that sucker in deep into the ground. That is destruction for the sake of construction. But if it was just to destroy, like what Hamas is trying to do, I'm sorry to use that example, if it's literally just to destroy without any positive constructive end, then it's not technically prohibited. That's why it says on the...
You have to use electric tools.
What's that? You can't use electricity for other reasons because it partakes of one of the 39 acts of work. If you could knock it down without electricity or something else, then technically it would be okay.
If there's a big sandcastle in the beach, you can knock down, but you can't build it.
Yeah. But there needs to be an eruv. Because if there's no eruv, which most beaches don't have, by the way.
What are those metal things that you can knock it off with?
But why do you need an eruv if you're not carrying anything to knock it down?
Because when you knock it down, you're moving the stuff in the public thoroughfare.
Sure.
You're moving it. Doesn't matter. It's about moving objects from one thing to the next. But let's just continue. This too, so what does he say here? Thus, if one were to knock down a house simply with the idea of destroying it, one would not be doing a malacha, although this would hardly be a recommended way of spending the Sabbath. If, however, one were to do precisely the same act with the constructive purpose of clearing the site for rebuilding, then that would be a malacha. Now we're getting to a definition, guys. Look at 29. Malacha, third line down, guys. Malacha thus includes within its scope any activity of a constructive nature, which makes some significant change in our material environment. Significant, that is, in relation to its usefulness for human purposes. Any act, however small, which demonstrates our mastery of nature in this way is a malacha, whether it's striking a light, washing clothing, tying a knot, or building a house. We have thus, it's one of the 39 acts of work, tying a knot. Now, by the way, you also know, you can always ask the question, Rabbi, what were they tying when they built the tabernacle? Because you also don't write on Shabbat. What were they writing when they built the tabernacle? Does anybody know?
Measurements or something?
What's that?
Doing the measurements writing?
Close. You ever build like a sukkah or something and you want to know where this pole goes to this pole? So you put a little X here and a little X there. You know what I mean? That's what they used to do. And then they would erase it when they were done, when it was put up. So it was, all of those activities were just activities that were necessary to build and take down. Now,
what happens if your shoe gets
You can tie your shoe. You're just not supposed to tie a permanent knot on Shabbat. A temporary knot is perfectly acceptable on Shabbat, but a permanent knot is a problem. So I tie regular bow ties. I try not to do a double knot. These particular shoes, they drive me crazy because whenever I tie these, so I tie one and it never stays. So then that could be a double knot on Shabbos because it's not really permanent. As long as it's not permanent, it's not permanent. There are some people very strict when they tie a tie knot. They will just do a regular, they won't do a Windsor. You know how to tie a Windsor knot?
Yeah.
Because they think it's too, that crosses the permanent line, you know. By the way, I'm not an expert. I would just tell you, every one of these 39 acts of work is like a piece of work. And it's discussed. And it's analyzed. So I have a cursory knowledge of most of them and a deeper knowledge of a few. So if I don't know so much,
I know you really have to be careful with kids' toys because I have some religious friends. They don't let their kids play with Legos. They can only play with the magnetic lock ones because they're broken down usually by the end.
I don't think Legos are a problem. I don't think they're permanent enough. If you can take this back and on and a little kid can manipulate it, I don't think...
But they're selecting and then constructing.
Sorting,
selecting, constructing. Creative stuff goes...
I don't think... the sorting might be an issue.
Somewhere in Rabbi Kenny's Halakha chat, if anybody's really interested.
About Lego?
Yeah.
I don't think it's an issue. You have to be careful, by the way. Let me just say something. You have to be careful, especially with kids, saying no too much.
Right.
I'm just saying, like, now, that doesn't mean you just let a kid do something which is forbidden. But if something is, like, you know, there are gray areas, you know, like basketball. When my kids were little, all my kids were ballers. You know, it was very hard for them not playing basketball. So I let him play basketball on Shabbat because there's no real activity, except you're really not supposed to get too
worked up
to whatever. So I would, our rule was up to 3-on-3s in basketball, but no 5-on-5s because if you have to get like into a t-shirt and shorts and start doing that, we're not doing that. And it was hard for them because, you know, they have a lot of friends and some people are doing this, some people are doing that. But you got to be careful saying no all the time, especially to kids. Even adults, it just seems too restrictive, you know? And again, that's not a reason to just let something go if it's forbidden. But not everything is as forbidden as you think. And I would say the Talmud says, Koch, the heter is adif. The power to be lenient is greater. You need more wisdom and knowledge of the subject matter to be able to be more lenient. Like I end up giving more leniencies in areas where I know more. It makes sense, no?
What about the Roomba? Like, in other words, you know.
What's the Roomba?
It's like that.
Like a dance?
Robot. It shows mastery over the.
Yeah, but you're not, as long as you're not manipulating it on Shabbat.
You turn it on beforehand, you let it run.
That's fine. It may not be so. It may not, listen, we use timers for lights on Shabbat.
Right.
Yeah. But there's a big debate, you know, do you use timers, because you don't have to be that creative. You can set your timer for everything. And you could set your timer to turn on your favorite movie at a certain time and then turn it off. So it's not technically forbidden. I'm just being intellectually honest. It's not forbidden. But then you're getting into, is it in the spirit of the Shabbat? Like a little basketball, I don't think takes away from the spirit. But like 5-on-5s on a hot day when you have to shower and I think that's killing the spirit.
What about taking a photo? Which one of the 39?
It's a good question. Some of the things that we don't do in Shabbat, by the way, don't fall under the 39 thing. But there are some rabbinic ones also. For example, like muksa. Like I'm not supposed to carry this around on Shabbat. Okay, why can't I carry around as long as I don't pop them in my ear or hook them up to my phone and start using it? But the rabbis created that as like a fence.
The carrying.
So taking a picture, what's involved with taking a picture, actually? So let's say it's an old-fashioned camera.
Can I use a disposable camera on
Shabbat?
No. Without a flash, one second, without a flash.
Yeah.
The flash obviously is an issue.
No flash.
So, what's involved?
There's chemicals.
Oh, Siva.
You have to turn it on?
Siva.
That way.
What's wrong? In other words, you're projecting something on a piece of paper. That's going to create the picture. Yeah. By the way, because that's a big question also, if something is not permanent writing, is it considered writing? Like, can I go over to a car when it's like misty and put a, you know, and write my name, Mark, on the misty car. So rabbinically, we say no, but biblically, it's probably not an infraction because it's not permanent. It'll be gone in 3 minutes. But what about a computer? What about typing a name on a computer? It also, you just press delete and it's gone. Is it even there? What's the nature of what is the pixels on a screen that create the image that we look at? I know you have to really get into this kind of stuff. That's why you need engineers, you need computer people to really answer these questions properly. But generally speaking, we don't type on Shabbat and we don't take pictures because your pushing the button is causing something to be permanently placed on.
So it would fall under the category of writing.
Probably writing.
Gotcha.
By the way, there's a lot more under writing than you think.
Yeah.
A lot comes under, yeah.
Well, also like, I learned this a few years back, and I'm still surprised. Like with a birthday cake.
Yeah.
You can't
have. That's why people have like the chocolate.
So you can't.
In other words, you're not. This is always an issue. Also, like on the birthday cake, they say happy birthday, shosh, and then you wanna. My brother always used to do this for his birthday cakes. He would take his finger and put it right through his name, and that was like the. Anybody have that disgusting tradition? So you're not permitted to cross out because it might constitute erasing.
Mm-hmm.
You can't write and you can't erase. So what they do for birthday cakes on Shabbat is they'll write "Happy Birthday, Michael," and they'll put it on its own little thing, like on its own little
chocolate.
Piece of chocolate.
Yeah.
And they'll take it off, and you can just That way it's like not in the cake, you just put it off and...
Can you eat it soon? You're erasing it.
No, you can't like eat it. You can take it out and put it aside so people can cut the cake too.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, it's like, yeah.
And then put it in the refrigerator. Yeah. No, it could be edible, but then you just don't eat that on Shabbat.
On Shabbat.
The stuff with the lettering. Now, I don't want anyone walking out here going, oh, this is where people start going, oh, this is crazy. Because it's just crazy. Because, by the way, and I will keep you here. I want you to be able to hear two of you. I will keep you here literally all year with this kind of stuff. Because this is what we rabbis like to do. We like to talk about this stuff ad nauseum. And it's fun. And then you become, it is interesting.
It is.
And I remember, you know, Rabbi Pinney, you'll all hopefully be in Rabbi Pinney's senior fellowship next year. He's amazing. But Rabbi Pinney and I know each other for like 30 years. And we actually met studying. And I took this course at Yeshiva University in rabbinical school. It was a six-week thing on cooking. Not that I was interested in learning how to cook. It was basically how not to cook on Shabbat, because it's one of the 39 acts. Mm-hmm. And it just went right over my head. The rabbi who was doing it, I didn't hop it. So Pinney and I, for 8 months, learned cooking. I kid you not. One malacha, 8 months. Now, I know it pretty well. I can give you all the ins and outs and da-da-da. And there'll still be new things that come up. But what about that fakakta elevator? Yeah, that's what I'm going to call it. I'm going to call it a fakakta elevator because this is exactly what it is. It's the bane of my existence.
Who's the elevator? Who's the service?
We don't know because they're never here.
We never even acknowledged how awesome the spiel was. I want to thank guys. That was really, really well done. I have it all videoed, by the way. If anybody missed it, you
want to
see it.
Please share that.
Yeah, it was extremely well done.
Thank you.
Yeah, very, very well done. So why is it that we can travel up in that elevator?
Sure.
Now, I will say something, you know, setting things into motion. You go to Mount Sinai Hospital, you go to Lenox Hill Hospital, they have Shabbos elevators. So why is it so difficult for the Jewish Center to have a Shabbos elevator? Why can't we have one too? So when they put in the new elevator engine, which was only about 13, 14 years ago, by the way, it seems like it was in 1917 when Mordechai Kaplan built the building. He's been dead for about 80 years. And why couldn't they do that? Because what ended up happening, and it's preferable halachically to have the elevator stop on its own than relying on someone who isn't Jewish to do it. It's permissible with someone who isn't Jewish, but there's level doubles of, because you know what happened? I think I told somebody this. So third floor is the main synagogue. Fourth floor is the Beit Midrash. Fifth floor is children's toys. Sixth floor is women's lingerie. Seventh floor is, I'm just kidding. So it's like all this dumb thing. I heard that on a and by the time it got to 10, MGEers were basically hurling themselves off the roof. By the time they got to the 10th floor, they were just like, it took an hour to get up here. And also, they had to let the door stay open long enough. The little old ladies at the Jewish Center, you know, some like 85-year-old woman is walking. By the time she got to the door, it slammed it on her. I mean, you know what was going on? It was like, I'm telling you, we could do like a comedy skit with this elevator. So my friend Ari Berman, by the way, who you'll meet, he's speaking at the dinner Tuesday night. He's a very funny guy. He was the rabbi of the shul at the time. He's now the president of Yeshiva University. We're honoring him at the dinner. So he just said, no more Shabbos elevator. And I went to his office. I'm like, why? He goes, because we almost killed Mrs. Goldberg. You know, I remember something like that. He was like a young rabbi at the time, and she was like this little old lady, and she almost got like squashed. So that's why we have someone who isn't Jewish in there. And I think it's a tradition that whoever is manning the elevator needs to be watching a movie of some sort, you know, in some other language.
it's still freaky if the door doesn't open.
This is such a good therapy session. What's that?
If the door doesn't open. She never travels on her own.
The door is, it's fine.
I don't like
taking
the elevator.
The elevator's fine.
We talked about it.
Listen, if you can walk, it's good exercise.
Luck brings out the best.
Is this like possible for Shabbat elevators to go to the very top and really stop on the way down?
Yeah, that's what in the hotels where I'm like I rabbinate for Pesach. It shoots up and then goes boom, boom, boom. That's the way it usually works. It stops at every floor. They didn't want to do that here because it just takes too long. Also, there's a big problem with the eye. You know about the eye?
No.
The eye?
Uh-uh.
There's an eye. And if the eye catches someone, it moves the scanner. Thank you. That's what I meant to say.
You can't hold it, right?
Technically, you're not supposed to. You're not supposed to break that lock, that thing.
Wait, what?
Like the scanner. Like the
in other words, if the
sensor.
Door's about to close and you're walking out, it will open back up. That's like work. That's
or if you're trying to get in the elevator.
It's not biblical, just so you know. Just don't know shit fit. Now, I'm not saying it's okay, but if that happens, it's not the worst thing in the world if that happens. But you should try, you know.
So it really was a problem because it was closing on Mrs. Goldberg, right? I mean, she was getting
crushed. No, they removed the eye. They removed the eye.
Right.
They disarmed the eye.
Yes, yeah, so
and
it was
then that was the end of Mrs. Goldberg.
She's
okay, bro. She lived, arrived. She lived well into her 90s.
Wait, but now they can put it back on.
What's that?
Yeah.
No, we have a guy there. We have someone watching a movie every Shabbos in the elevator. We fixed the problem. What's that?
I didn't realize that's why she would have gotten crushed if the sensor was off.
Oh, we turned the sensor. I forgot to tell you that. We turned the sensor off.
That's just her walking.
Right.
Yeah. It's the same reason I told the guy in the hotel. He came over and he goes, you know, Rabbi, I was doing my thing in the bathroom. And I'm, you know, he's at the urinal.
Oh,
and then I realize as I'm going to the bathroom that when I walk away, the thing's going to flush. So I said, so what are you doing here? You should still be there. You got to wait there till Yontif's out in two days. Oh, God.
Do they have anything for those sorts of situations? Like you just like put something.
Yeah, you bring a friend in the bathroom with you. And you just leave him there.
But like something you can put in front of the sensor so it doesn't detect that anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Your friend.
I mean, what we do in the hotels, there are different opinions. I'm going to have to go through this again for Passover with the...
Or you can tell...
There's a very lenient view that holds that those keys may not be muksa.
Yeah.
Or you can say that you're locked out and they'll come and open it for you.
What's that? Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's what a lot of people do. What I do, honestly, in the hotel, they have a safe. I take my valuables, I put in the safe. I say, anybody who wants that pair of pants... Those pair of shoes, they can have them.
Nobody
if someone's going to come in here and steal my shoes and pants, mm-hmm. they put my valuables
right,
in the
right,
safe,
right, right,
and then I close the door, but I keep it unlocked.
No, but like, what if you want to check out the next day before Shabbos is over?
You can't. That's a problem.
Where
so then
going?
You're going to press that.
Yeah, where are you going? Where are you going? You're going to walk somewhere? You can't carry the stuff.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm just saying, if you're following, unless who are you going to? Where are you going? You're on your own, kid. All right.
Yeah.
That's a good question.
By the way, these Passover places are very nice down in Florida. Right?
They're beautiful.
Where are you going?
I'm a rabbi at this place called PGA.
I'm working.
Oh, I used to go to PGA.
Oh, where?
I'm working for Camp Vermont.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Oh, beautiful.
In Georgia.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So I work also. I work like I just did my schedule with them. I teach like 3-4 times a day. Run around, help. Yeah.
Do they play golf there during the?
But not during the holiday. During
Kol
HaMoed. You're not doing. What they do is during the holiday, basically, everybody's just praying, hanging out, socializing, eating, taking walks, just chilling out. It's very nice. People sit by the pool. There's also a spectrum of religiosity there. So you will see people swimming on Shabbat. That I happen to think it's a very nice, even though people are doing some things that are really breaking the law, it happens to be a very, very nice thing that lots of Jews of differing religious levels can Passover together. I grew up going to this place called Grossinger's in the Catskills. And Grossinger's was like Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox. Everybody was big cholent to Jews together. And everyone got along. And they ran the place according to halacha so that everybody could feel comfortable. And the food was a very high level of kashrut. But people were playing tennis on the holiday. People were swimming. People were going to shows. There was stuff going on also. And there were Orthodox rabbis that were like upset that their congregants were going because it wasn't such the atmosphere. But I don't know. I kind of liked that everybody was able to be together. It was nice. All right, I just want to finish one last thing. You mentioned before there's one malacha that does not pertain to our definition. And that is
carrying.
Because carrying, the same little thing you took outside, you're bringing right back in. You haven't affected any change. You're not manipulating it. You're not, what's the definition? Let's go back, guys. You have the working definition. An act that shows your mastery over the world by the constructive exercise of your intelligence and skill. It's on page 29. Circle that. An act that shows your mastery over the world by the constructive exercise of intelligence and skill. And then look at 33 now. But what of carrying? It's by no means clear that at the first sight how this malacha fits in with the general concept that we have developed above. Indeed, carrying seems of all the melachas the least obviously work. No essential change, go to the end, turn the page, no productive process seems to be involved. And maybe, so what's the deal? And it's not only, this is very cool by the way, the prophet Jeremiah, you guys have heard of Jeremiah, the great prophet. The prophet Jeremiah, look at the next paragraph. When he was told to warn Israel that the future of the Jewish state was dependent on the way Sabbath was being observed, guess what he focused on when he was telling the Jewish people, you got to keep the Torah and you got to keep Shabbos. Guess what part of Shabbos Jeremiah was emphasizing? Don't carry on Shabbat. Why? It's the least malacha-esque kind of activity. And he said, look, this is what he says, a passage from Jeremiah. Go and stand in the people's gate. Look at the second paragraph. Thus saith the Lord, take heed for yourselves. Carry nothing on the Sabbath day, nor bring anything in by the gates of Jerusalem. Neither carry out anything from your houses on the Sabbath day, neither do any other malacha, but sanctify the Sabbath as I've commanded. What is the deal? And look at the next page on 35 on top. Page 35 on top. All right, so the question is, what feature... Go to 35, please.
Yes.
What feature... third paragraph on the page, beginning with the words, what feature? You guys with me?
Mm-hmm.
What feature is common to all the 38 categories of malach apart from carrying? Without exception, as we've seen, they have to do within the realm of nature. Their significance lies in the changes they affect in natural objects, whether the change is an actual physical one like reaping, baking, dyeing, lighting a fire, or whether it consists in taking the object out of the realm of nature into the sphere of human power, like sheaf making or trapping. You know what trapping is? Can't do this on Shabbat. This little bug is bothering you. You're sitting in your sukkah. So what a lot of people do? You shouldn't do this. It's not nice to the bug anyway. And you take a cup and you put the cup on the bug and you watch it bang into the cup the whole time. It's a little cruel. It's wrong for other reasons. But that's called trapping. You're not allowed to do that on Shabbat. So he's saying that all 38, not carrying, 38 or 39 is either manipulating things within the natural realm or pulling it out of the natural realm, making it use for human purposes. Carrying has neither of these features. Turn the page 36. We're finishing up. What's forbidden to carry is when you transfer an object from the private to the public domain and vice versa, like inside your house to outside, and from point to point in the public domain. The exact definition of these terms will be given in but we may note for the present that the most usual form of this malach is carrying between the house and the street or from house to house by way of the street. We're dealing here with something which is clearly different from the realm of nature. The house, the street, the city, these belong not to nature, but human society. Human society. If the other malachos, the other 38, show man mastering and controlling his natural environment, carrying shows him active in the social realm, carrying on the intercourse of the community, circulating its material goods between house and house, street and thoroughfare, not just for trade, but for trade, and also for the personal and social ends of everyday life. Carrying is the characteristic malacha by which man pursues and attains his purpose in society. By ceasing from the other malachot, we proclaim God as the source of our power over nature. God bless you. I'm going to read it again. By ceasing from other malachas, we're proclaiming God as the source of our power over nature. By ceasing from carrying, we acknowledge God, our master in the sphere of human society. This vast, complex world of social organization, the world of the house, street, and city, needs above all else the realization of God's presence and God's purpose, the sanctification and dedication which ceasing from malach expresses. The community whose members refrain from carrying on the Sabbath places the seal of God upon its social life. Can we now perhaps understand the emphasis of carrying in Jeremiah's passage to the state of Judah? This is in line with the message of all the prophets that Israel can exist only as a nation, only if it knows itself to be the people of God. And what can better express this dedication of the community than ceasing from carrying on the Sabbath? The picture is now complete. The concept of malacha has been defined. Some of the ideas that may lie behind it have been sketched in. The most important task, the vital task, lies ahead. And that's to see how the Torah wishes the sublime concept of Shabbat to be realized in practice, in detail, in our everyday lives. And I will tell you, there's nothing more detailed in minutia than Shabbat. But hang on one second. I'll get to you in a minute. I just want to end on this, and then I'll take questions. This is very, very important. People always say, does God really care if I rip the toilet paper on Shabbos? That's always the classic example people like to give. Now, I think he does. Why? Because we are the products, not always of our thoughts. Right? The great Rav Nachman of Breslov said, you are where your thoughts are. But our actions really develop us into the people that we are. Our actions, really. And those little things make a difference. I always like to point that out when you're sending the email and you put the dot over here as opposed to there, or you left out one little. Why doesn't it go through? Because those little things actually matter. The little details in life are really important. You'll see, please God, in the most important relationships in our lives, it's the little things that go the furthest. We sometimes make the big deal about the anniversary and the birthdays. I'm not saying they're not important, but it's the little gestures that really make life meaningful. And without those things, they remove a lot of the meaning and purpose. So I just wanted to mention that. And the carrying, I just think, and by the way, this is not the gospel. I'm giving you one rabbinic theory. I just happen to like it. It resonates with me, so I thought you'd appreciate it. You know, what's the idea behind being so careful about all these little details? And one last thing I will say, Judaism is not an all-or-nothing proposition. This can seem very daunting to a lot of people, to go from maybe not doing any of this to all of a sudden becoming perfect on all 39 activities and their rabbinic derivatives, if you will. You know, you want to just keep growing little by little and not get overwhelmed by all of this. Because if you just start doing everything overnight, it can be very, very overwhelming. Especially if you start really analyzing every little thing that happens about the newspaper that gets delivered to your home and who delivered it to my home and did they carry it out? We'll talk about non-Jewish help next week or the week after. So, like, everything is like a question, you know? But what I want to give you guys is some operating principles so you can start analyzing things on your own. Yeah, Tracy.
Yes, in regards to trapping, like if you're...
Trapping?
Yeah, so if you're going to trap a raccoon, so you can, you know, like self-help. The easiest way to do it is that, like, you drill a little hole and you put some silver, like, into a tree, put some silver there, because once you grab hold of it, and they hang...
Yeah, I always have that issue. Right?
they'll never let go.
So I know. I've gotten all cut up from... Yeah, so what's your question? Yeah, but you can't set that up on Shabbat.
No, but if
you set it up in advance of Shabbat,
and they get stuck in it,
or you have a mouse trap in your home, or you have a...
Set it free.
What was that?
Set it free before Shabbat. I don't know what to say.
What do you mean?
No, if it gets trapped during Shabbat, you wait till after Shabbat to...
Or if you're saying if you can't...
Suffer. Right, if it's going to suffer...
That.
So you're not allowed to break Shabbat to allay the suffering of an animal. You're not supposed to cause it, but you have someone who isn't Jewish do it that.
You're not allowed to say that. You're not allowed to...
You're not allowed to break Shabbat to save an animal's life, technically.
Or suffering.
Or I have to check about the relief of suffering. That might be different.
I don't know if I
might be incorrect on that. Let me look into that.
But I thought Judaism values life.
We do.
But then does it define just human or any life?
No. You're only really technically permitted to break Shabbat for human life. Okay? No, for non-Jewish life too. For both.
Any life.
And by the way, it's not just you must. I mean, it's a requirement. It's not like, oh, it's okay. In fact, the Rambam, Maimonides, said that when there's a life-threatening situation, you don't look for someone who isn't Jewish, you don't look for someone who's not terribly observant, you look for the greatest rabbi to break Shabbat. Because you want to make a point of it. We had this, actually. I just spoke with this rabbi today. Rabbi Shachtar is my mentor and teacher. You guys met him on the Shabbaton in Tinek?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he spoke.
So when when Yosef was maybe 2.5, 3, he was playing with one of these heavy metal stanchions on the third floor on Shabbat. Kept asking him to stop, and I took my eye off him for a minute, and all of a sudden, it just came crashing down on his head, and it was bad. And I remember Rabbi Shachter running into the middle of the street with his talis on Shabbos, hailing a cab, because he thought it would be faster for us to get him to Mount Sinai than waiting for the Hatzalah guy to come. And It was fine, thank God. I needed some stitches, whatever it is. But I told Rabbi Shachter afterwards, that's exactly what Maimonides says. You take the biggest rabbi in the community and have that. It's considered a privilege, in a sense, to break Shabbat to save a life. Animal life is a question. That doesn't mean you shouldn't try to orchestrate a way to save the animal's life. It's just a question of whether or not technically you're permitted to break Shabbat for that. I don't know. And I'll find out about it's called Tsar Balechaim. It is a biblical prohibition to cause undue harm to an animal. That's like a serious offense. And it's one of the seven Noahide laws about ripping a limb off of a living animal, which is still done in the world, by the way. Anyway, what are we talking about here? Any questions about carrying? We got talking about trapping. Okay, Tracy's the only one that this really pertains to. Any other questions about trapping? About carrying.
So do you carry your wallet with you at all? Like your ID?
You can.
So if you have an Arab, you can. You can carry your ID. I don't carry ID on Shabbat. Money is muksa, so you can carry your ID without credit card, without cash, or anything like that.
So the idea of that string that goes around a community is to make it so that it's all
one. So it basically converts an otherwise public domain into a private domain. And that allows you not to carry things you otherwise can't carry, but allows you to carry in a public thoroughfare. So it allows you to carry things you can otherwise carry, like a book, your talit, your child.
A bottle of wine.
You know what I mean? A bottle of wine for Shabbat.
Could you bring a credit card with you just in case there's an emergency, like God forbid something like that happened to Yosef and you needed, but how are you going to pay for the taxi cab?
I don't know. It somehow works. The guy's taking you to the hospital. You get somebody to pay for it. I don't know. You know, you find there's a lot of other people around. I don't know. It's never really been an issue. I mean, when my dad, you know, yeah.
Mandated to carry our phone.
Right. For security reasons, they're carrying walkie-talkies around, and you're constantly moving the volume. You should try not to if you don't have to, but if you have to, you need to.
What about the keys to your apartment?
So what we always did before Erev's was we had keychains. Oh, excuse me, like belts. It was like on the buckle of the belt. And it was like part of the belt so that you could just take the belt off and use it.
Batman.
Yeah, it was like a Batman thing. It was like a Batman
janitor.
Thing.
Batman.
Yeah. What's that? Well, the lockboxes don't work. Because they're just hanging on your clothing.
No. People put lockboxes on, like, the random fences and stuff. Or, like, near their...
Oh, where they hide them somewhere?
Yeah. Like on the...
But now that there's an Arab, if you're in the...
If you have an Arab, you just carry the key. Now, some people don't use the Arab, because they don't think Manhattan is Arabable, but that's for another conversation. You want to do me a favor, just ask if... So technically, you cannot use a microphone on Shabbos. However, they do have it. It's a little controversial. There's a... Will, thank you. I appreciate it. Just tell me whenever he's ready. Donnie Cohn, he's an old friend of mine. He's Ezra's brother. Ezra Cohn's older brother. He's a rabbi in Stanford. He's a big shul. And they have two podiums in his shul. They have the one without the microphone, they have one with it. And the one with it was created by an organization called Tzomet. Hey guys, welcome. Tzomet is... Will, he's right here. Okay. Tzomet is a wonderful organization that devises these types of machinery that can be operational on Shabbat. So let's say somebody's confined to a wheelchair. And they have electric wheelchairs. So he can operate the electric wheelchair on Shabbat, but they figured out a way that gets around. It's called a grumma, where you do one thing, but it doesn't directly cause it. And they have the same thing with microphones. So some synagogues have these, they're called somit microphones.
I'm working at the Ramah Passover program, which is conservative, and I'm surprised in the description for this, there's like four different seders going on,
right.
All these options, and like the main seder, it says microphone will be in use.
Right.
But again, it's conservative, but I thought for like myself, like it's just very
What about a book?
Yeah, I mean, there's no prohibition in listening to it.
Yeah.
There's no prohibition in listening. The problem is speaking into it. I was invited to speak at a conservative synagogue and they gave me the microphone, so I just spoke without the microphone.
Yeah.
You can
I'm
do
not talking to
Yeah. What about like a shower?
You can, what about shower?
A cold shower, a hot shower.
So the hot.
The turning on a mechanical.
So the hot is the issue, depending on your building, which is a very interesting question. Mm-hmm. Because what happens when you turn the hot water on?
Turn
water. By the way, I have to tell Rev, there's an issue here in this building also. Because what happens when you turn the hot water on?
You're heating the water.
Then more water comes through from the water tank, and it gets heated up. So you're opening the spigot and allowing more water to come in. There's nothing wrong with opening a spigot. Or even like old buildings here with a heater, you can open up the heat on Shabbat. You just turn, yeah, because there's no electricity involved. You're just opening it up and more heat's coming through. Same thing with the water. But if it's causing cold water to come in and get heated up, then that's a problem. Unless some...
Yeah.
You don't know if that... It's kind of separated.
Right, so...
It's not an immediate...
Well, in a private home, it's an issue. Because private homes...
Because the tanks are smaller.
The tanks are smaller.
You're inevitably going to do it.
Right, but they say that if 51% of your building is not Jewish... If 51% of your building is not Jewish, then you can use the hot water on Shabbat.
Yeah, survey when you move in.
Because you can assume that it's being done for the non-Jews and not for the Jews. Because you can't turn the sensor off in your building. That's not practical. They probably could. They probably need to. But I think they turned it off in some sinks and not others. All right, these are really great questions. We're going to continue next week, and then we only have a week left of Shabbat, and then we got to jump into Passover. But then we'll continue with Shabbat after. So don't fret, okay? But this is good stuff. Is it okay? Would you guys like to have a 2-3 minute break and then Tuvia, or go right into Tuvia and then leave a little earlier?
Break.
Is it the same stuff?
If you vote for break, then I'm fine with break.
But what would you prefer?
Personally, I'm fine going through, but...
All right, would you mind, because I have to...
Be,
yeah, you know what, I'm just going to...
The train left.
No, it's fine, it's fine. Tuvia, is it okay? Can I introduce you? Please, come. Tuvia, this is a little more intimate group. You could sit, you don't have to stand, you don't have to run around. You could just chill out a little. But you want to show your stuff a little? Okay, so everyone who hasn't had the opportunity... Okay, no problem. All right, guys, take a minute break so he's going to get his stuff together here. Okay. 60-second break, everyone. Thank you.
Quick question. Do you consider a slice of pizza a snack or a meal?
One slice is a snack. I think two or more is a meal.
I'll tell you later.
And then if you don't have the vessel and you're out, can you just have the tap running and just go?
So if that's the best, like I was on a plane, that's what I did because I couldn't get a cup. But it's better to use a vessel.
You can make your hand do that?
No, you can't really use your own hand. It has to be a separate vessel technically. But you could just put it underneath if you can't find a cup.
Okay.
But better if you can. It literally just happened to me last week. I'll come back from Florida.
I think she...
Like a summary of
my harissa was telling me that there are like portable, small, plastic, collapsible ones.
Cups.
That you can carry. Yes.
Yeah.
I didn't find that.
I used to bring those to camp. Little, you know.
These teacher friends?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What was the issue with the basketball again? Why can't you play
basketball? Oh, so that's not a biblical thing. It's not one of the 39 acts of work. So you're not really affecting change.
But what was the rabbinical?
The rabbinical thing is called Tircha Desera, which means you're not supposed to overly exert yourself physically on Shabbat.
So
there would be a line that I might be crossing if we have too many people in my apartment for lunch. You know, too much activity, too much like work.
So what happens if somebody's really out of shape and they have to walk uphill to the synagogue?
Do they speak English?
So I was with the people.
Work out.
No, it says that you just can't exert yourself leaving the synagogue. If you have to exert yourself to go into the synagogue, that's 100% allowed.
Right, but how much?
So as long as you're going downhill after. As long as you're going downhill after the synagogue.
Yeah.
The synagogue can't be downhill.